Greetings and welcome to the triumphant return of Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies with me, your host, Lisa Schmeiser, and my co-host, Philip Michaels.
Oh, hello there.
Hi.
Hi.
It's
how
been
are
a
you?
While.
No, it has been.
What have you been up to?
I've been sitting here in this room waiting for you to podcast with me for the last 8 months.
It hasn't been that long.
No, I don't know how long it's been.
No, far too long.
Let me see if I can look at the wall where I've scratched in days.
That's actually a picture.
Mm.
Oh. Oh.
The Degas!
The next time I leave you in here, I'm leaving you an anatomy textbook, too. There are things you don't understand yet.
No, clearly. As you well know.
Yes.
Again and again. So, what do we do on this podcast? I've forgotten.
What we do, Philip, is It's broken into two or three parts, depending on your definition of part. Mm-hmm. First, we discuss trailers for upcoming movies and preemptively review them without having seen them, based only on a minute and 40 seconds. Then what we
That sounds very irresponsible.
No more irresponsible than saying that than setting world policy with 140 characters.
Mm.
Then what we do is we head into the part of the podcast where we discuss films we may have seen, and there are the occasional amusing digressions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very occasional. Mm-hmm.
Now, the good news, or bad news, depending on whether you're us or a listener, is that you and I recently had a globetrotting jaunt, the upshot of which I spent, I want to say, 36 hours in airplanes, not straight. And
no.
I saw a lot of movies during that time.
Yes, I saw fewer movies than you did because it was a business trip for me. So I worked on one leg of the flight.
Mm-hmm.
In case anyone's listening from work. Hi, everyone.
Yeah. No. Also, you sleep on planes.
I also do sleep on planes. I pass out from my total fear of flying.
Yeah. So the point is, we've seen movies. We've seen a few trailers. Shall we start with the trailers that we've seen?
Yeah, let's start with the trailers. And
now, do you want to start with the Prestige trailer or the Kid trailer?
Let's start with the Prestige one, because I think that will segue nicely into the Kid movie that we saw over the weekend.
I am incredibly curious to see how you're going to connect the dots from the post to Coco, but let's go. This will be a trip for us all.
It'll be a fun trip. Yeah, the post.
Mm-hmm.
The post is the story of the Pentagon Papers, which was a big case.
Freedom
of the Press case.
Involving the New York Times.
Involving the New York Times.
And so, yet this movie is about the Washington Post.
Exactly. It's like if all the president's men were about New York Times reporters reading about the Post coverage and going, damn, I wish we had that story.
So there are a couple things that stand out in the trailer. The first is that Tom Hanks really is our generation's Jimmy Stewart, because he's doing the thing where he radiates decency, and it doesn't matter if the real life person he's playing was harder around the edges or uncompromising or morally elastic in some ways. When Tom Cruise gets a hold of them, all of a sudden they're an icon of American decency. We saw him do this when we watched Saving Mr. Banks.
And
he turns Walt Disney, of all people, into like this avuncular, hail fellow well met, gentle dude who just wants to heal everybody's tortured inner child.
He does it in Sully. He does it in Bridge of Spies. It's basically,
he does it in I Live in an Airport.
Yes.
Whatever that movie was called.
Yes.
And he does it here as Ben Bradley, who, it should be noted, the real life Ben Bradley inflicted upon the world Sally Quinn, among his many other war crimes. So you look at Tom Hanks, though, and you just can't imagine him doing that.
When I was a young boy starting out in journalism, Ben Bradley published his autobiography, and I asked for it and received it for Christmas, and I got about a chapter into it, and I said, "This is dreck," and I could not continue.
He made some great executive decisions for the Washington
Post.
But again, we're focusing on the cinematic interpretation of a movie that Steven Spielberg has set up to be who are the brave guardians of freedom in time of government oppression, and the answer is, God help us all, journalists. And here he brings to bear all the elements of the Spielbergian imagination, the ability to move into the extraterrestrial, the ability to imagine things yet unseen on this planet. the special effects team must have labored for hours just to create a plutocrat who actually gave a damn about American democracy.
Yes. Again, it's a movie that presupposes that people want to look at journalists for 2 hours.
Yeah. Well, they
although kind of, I do like the scene where...
well, they did it with the one about the Boston Globe.
Yeah.
Where Mark Ruffalo is your hot investigative reporter. What is that movie called again?
Spotlight.
Yes, thank you.
Which is quite good. I watched that on the plane.
See, you know how you get people to look at journalists for 2 hours?
You stick them on planes and force them to watch movies.
You cast more attractive people.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
No, that everyone in the spotlight is so beautiful and so clearly not a working member of the press.
What I really enjoy about Spotlight is how there was an interview with the costume designer where she's like, yeah, we really had to like hit Ann Taylor and ug everybody up. And I'm like, you did not succeed.
No.
Everybody here is still much, much better dressed than anybody in any newsroom, period. Anyway, to get back to this.
Since it's a Spielberg movie, I assume that at one point they're running away with the Pentagon Papers, and then a little alien helps them fly over the Nixon administration.
Yes, it's Arthur Parsons.
Yes. There you go.
Yeah, it's Brad Whitford who's back in who's moved into, you know, the officious guardian of white male privilege, which is like one of the tropes that he's begun to play.
Right.
I personally prefer the second trope that he's begun to play, which is dissolute Brad Whitford.
Yes, dissolute Brad Whitford on Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Or the good guys.
He was quite good in that.
Anyway, the question. So after watching a minute and a half of The Post. The questions you will have answered are, should I go see this movie? Answer, if you like watching Meryl Streep channel yet another Grand Dame, if you like watching Tom Hanks be incredibly decent, is it worth all of the hype it's getting from critics who have already named it the best movie of the year? The answer is, we can't tell from a minute and a half. But I suspect that one of the reasons it's hitting so strongly is because out here in the real world, it's been a very interesting year if you are a member of the press or if you consume the press. Mm-hmm. And the Washington Post has certainly ended up inadvertently being the news as well as making the news recently.
Since both Bob Odenkirk and David Cross are in the movie, I choose to view this movie as the least funny Mr. Show sketch ever.
Maybe it's like an elaborate setup. And then at the end, Tom Kenny will come out.
Exactly.
And Jill Talley. And that's how you'll know it's a Mr. Show sketch.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Black will sing a song.
Yeah.
That's how this ends.
Yes, he sings a song about the First Amendment and New York Times versus Sullivan.
Yeah. So anyway, we saw The Post. It's a prestige movie. It's probably the type of thing where we'll watch it in the theaters if it's the only thing playing at the time we're available.
Yeah.
Or otherwise, we'll just wait for video on demand because it's going to be like the King's Speech in the sense that you're not going to need to see this on a big screen. The story can be seen anywhere.
As someone who saw Spotlight on a screen the size of the back of an airline seat, I can tell you it's you don't need that cinematic experience necessarily to enjoy a story of this nature.
Yeah. The question is whether or not this movie is actually in touch with the times or is capable of reflecting or influencing a national dialogue, or if this is just going to be something where we're high-minded about it for 6 weeks and then we go back to watching Mark Wahlberg blow up stuff. I mean, it could go either way. All right. So, second preview.
The other one that we watched is Red Sparrow.
Better known as the Black Widow movie Marvel wishes it had made.
Yes.
Basically, Jennifer Lawrence plays a Russian ballerina turned honeypot spy.
Mm-hmm.
If this is... I feel like Kevin Feige is like diving for a phone and speed dialing at this point. And anyway, the whole trailer has her doing ballet and looking seductive and killing people with her thighs. And again, it's the Black Widow movie, only without any of the Marvel branding or tie-in merchandise, and it seems to be yet another movie where you have an actress who is known for, like, I don't get why Jennifer Lawrence takes these downer roles.
No.
She's got this great, infectious, boisterous, fun, and brash energy, and it's like they're trying to cram her into a completely different archetype here.
The main things that I've seen her in are Silver Linings Playbook and
American Hustle. Yeah.
And in those movies, they're fun and she's fun.
So I've seen her in those. I've also seen her in the X-Men movies that she's in.
Yeah.
And there she adds a lot of zing.
Yeah.
And she really digs her teeth into it, and she plays a great costume type. Yeah. And in the Hunger Games movies, it's a lot like Winter's Bone, where she's just steely-eyed determination.
Which I want to see Winter's Bone.
Oh, it's
actually
fantastic. Yeah. You know, she's also, what I don't get here is when you try to tone down the charisma and the energy and the sense that she doesn't take herself too seriously, when you tone all that down, what you have is basically an attractive blonde. And honestly, after having seen Atomic Blonde with its very distinctive visual iconography and Charlize Theron looking both, Charlize Theron looks like a human that's been engineered to the next level to be like a little bit more lethal than average. And Jennifer Lawrence kind of channels that, and it's just really unfortunate that she does, because she shouldn't be the next Charlize Theron. She should be her own self-defined category.
The thing that put me off about the trailer is it's a Jennifer Lawrence picture, and yet she doesn't speak at all in the trailer.
No.
It's just dude saying, oh, there's this crazy ballerina broad, and she will kill you. She is going to rock your world.
And then stab you. Yeah. No, she's basically, and perhaps the point of that is, oh, she's treated like an object. Oh, the dehumanization of the Soviet government. Oh, yeah. It's dreadful what happens. But why should we care about her? And again, let me remind you, the Black Widow exists.
Yeah.
You could argue that there are at least 6 movies in the Marvel Universe that could be retitled things like The Black Widow Has to Babysit a Bunch of Crybaby Man Boys, The Black Widow Tries to Divert World War III and very nearly pulls it off if it weren't for that idiot Tony Stark, The Black Widow Has to Yet Again Pull Clint Barton's Bacon Out of the Fire. Like, all of these plausibly could be made. They have been made, in fact. They were just called different things.
It sounds like a bunch of 1920s two reelers.
Yeah.
Like,
the Black Widow.
The Black Widow in Manhattan Caper. Yes.
Better watch that hammer, little lady. I don't know if you can swing it or not. So yeah, Red Sparrow looks completely unimpressive. I think it's the kind of movie I would watch if we still had HBO and I were home and was just clicking through and it came on and I was like, oh, let's see what happens here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm between this and Mother.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like
Mother.
Yeah, I feel like Jennifer Lawrence is making some interesting decisions lately that I'm not necessarily in tune with.
The problem with that movie, in addition to the exclamation point,
we're referring now to Mother and not Red Sparrow,
Black Widow, Red Sparrow, potato,
yeah.
Potato.
Yeah.
The problem with Mother is I can't say it in anything other than Buster Bluth's voice.
Yes.
And so, Army was let out early today, Mother. So there you go.
I understand that
Darren Aronofsky's
Tony
creation.
Hale was Darren Aronofsky's original choice to play that part.
Mother!
As it turns out.
I think people would have enjoyed the movie more.
I think it would have been much more intense if it's Tony Hale. I was going to make a joke that was a total spoiler about that movie, and for the 8 listeners out there
who have stuck with us,
the Venn diagram of our podcast listeners who are also, oh, I'm going to hold out to see Mother. I don't want to ruin that experience for them.
I still think Mother could have been a better movie if it had been cast entirely with the Arrested Development cast.
Get on that, Netflix. There's your Arrested Development season 5.
Forget having handsome Javier Bardem or whoever it was as the poet. Like, make it Will Arnett. There was a yacht, now there is not.
It's Will Arnett and Tony Hale living in the house together.
Yeah, in the middle of nowhere. And then,
then Portia de Rossi
shows up with Never Nude Tobias, and they take over the house. Yes, see? This movie is instantly much better than the original.
Okay, get Darren Aronofsky on the phone.
I think he'll appreciate that. He seems like a fun hang with a lively sense of humor.
Yeah, he seems really mellow about his work. He seems like, hey, tell me jokes about pie. Tell me jokes about Requiem for a Dream. I love hearing those. Oh, man, oh, man.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to our next trailer.
From Darren Aronofsky to movies for children.
A Wrinkle in Time.
Yes, A Wrinkle in Time.
Yes. So trippy.
Mm-hmm.
Love the Pier 1 Imports meets Rihanna's collection for Sephora vibe that they've got. No, I'm serious. I do. I really love the aesthetics of this.
I like the casting.
Yeah.
I really liked, you know, that it wasn't a bunch of a bunch of whiteies.
A bunch of bland wasps, yeah. Well, Meg and Charles Wallace, your job is to go through the Tesseract. No, it's all over the place. Mm-hmm. It's great. They've got Michael Peña in there, which is excellent.
Right.
Mindy Kaling is Mrs. Who. Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who is beautiful and amazing and everything, is Dr. Murray. And
saw Oprah in the trailer.
Well, it's, you know, but so you
Oprah,
have to.
Oprah puts the butts in the seats.
Well, also, maybe Oprah.
And you're going to a movie. And you're going to a movie.
I have tremendous respect for Oprah.
I do too, if she's listening.
If you look at the way she's crafted these careers for herself and taken this stuff seriously, she's managed to find her sweet spot and inhabit it. And I think the casting is genius because they've got Mindy Kaling and Reese Witherspoon, and these are all three people in Hollywood who have a creative body of work that point to them being headstrong and creatively in charge of their own lives and unafraid to want what they want and hold out for it. And you need that when you're dealing with three, you know, enormous forces like Mrs. Who, Mrs. Where, and Mrs. Watts, and Mrs. Witch. So I think it's great. The aesthetics are beyond amazing. And I say this as somebody who looks back on the Hope Larson graphic novel and I have some strong feelings about the covers of the books, but this feels like a really fresh visual take that will still get to the wonder and the awe and the beauty that I felt the first time I read this book when I was 9. So,
when we were talking about it before we pressed record, you were somewhat more ambivalent.
I was.
Because it's one of those, it won't match the pictures in my head.
Yeah, let me elaborate on that a little bit, because we talked about that on the way home from Coco.
Coco.
And one of the difficulties, or I should say one of the challenges I sometimes have as a moviegoer, is if someone is adapting a work that is beloved to me. I have a very specific image in my head of what it is. Because, you know, of course, I've engaged and connected with it. And I've built up my own visual vocabulary and pulled in my own experiences. And it's reading a book is a very, very personal endeavor. And so when you see an adaptation on screen, it can be something that may be good. But if it doesn't mesh with the vague visual blueprint you have in the back of your head, it will be really hard for you to like it.
Yeah.
And so my big fear about this movie was initially, I'm not sure this will connect with what's in my head, but I've watched the trailer a few more times. And I think the really exciting thing is I can still have that whole literary / memory palace in my head that A Wrinkle in Time has been since age 9. But I can appreciate this movie as something completely and artistically separate from that.
I have a little bit of the same hold up only with musicals.
Yeah.
Because I still haven't seen Chicago.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen Sweeney Todd because I like those musicals and I don't want to see them.
Because the decisions other people will make about them will not be the same ones you're going to make.
Exactly.
And it's hard to separate your priorities and experience from someone else's interpretation.
We recently showed the daughter, Guys and Dolls, the 1950s version with
the hilariously
miscast 1950s version with Marlon Brando in the romantic lead and
Frank Sinatra
as the comic lead.
That movie would have been 100 times better if you just flipped those two around. I'm
Like said, hey, Marlon Brando, they're filming a movie over there. Go over there.
Because
he just mumbles his way through, hey, I'm Scott Masterson, the most suave, debonair gambler in all of New York.
I have charisma.
Luck be a lady tonight.
I have so much charisma. Yeah. So much charisma.
And it's every time I watch that movie,
you get angry all over again.
I get angry as if seeing it for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. But so I hear you with.
She liked it though.
Yeah, she did.
And what was interesting was watching our daughter react to it because she hasn't seen it on Broadway and because she wasn't in it.
In high school
like you were.
Miscast myself, but there you go. I am not bitter. 25, 30 years later.
I'm glad you're not holding on to that.
No, not at all.
I mean, it's not a negative burden that is in any way resurfacing every single time we have this discussion.
Should have been Harry the Horse. Anyhow.
No, what's interesting is seeing how she reacts to Frank Sinatra, because her entire cinematic exposure to him has been him as the comic foil who is terrified of women.
Yes.
So, like, when she runs into the Frank Sinatra that everyone knows later, she'd be like, him? No. Uh-uh. No, sorry, not happening.
Yes, but, exactly.
It'll be interesting. So, Wrinkle in Time, I'm excited about. Mm-hmm. I think Chris Pine, so kudos to him for, like, going with the scruffy hot physicist nerd dad thing. I enjoy how he pushes himself.
Yes.
I do.
Yes, we recently had a discussion about him.
Uh-huh. Oh, you know, I was asking the question, who was our next Laurence Olivier?
Yes, we were, because we had Laurence of Arabia on.
And we were watching.
And
we were watching Laurence of Arabia, and there was one of those scenes where Peter O'Toole's crystalline blue eyes gaze out from the screen, and the music swells. And
you're right, I'm extraordinary.
And he's exquisite.
Yeah, he
is. It is. I mean, there are probably entire schools of Greek philosophy based around that specific moment in cinema where you're like, this is the epitome of aesthetics.
Nothing is written, Ali.
It's the you're like, this is the epitome of aesthetics. It'll never get better than this. And I was thinking to myself, okay, Hollywood is actually really fond of pushing actors into specific tropes and keeping them there and saying, like Matthew McConaughey, when he first came up, the take was he's like Paul Newman, only young.
Right.
Which has turned out
to be... And he hates dressing.
Yes. Unlike Paul Newman, who has a lot of dressing.
I don't make popcorn, man.
Yeah. Like he was really pushed like that. Gwyneth Paltrow was pushed as your next Grace Kelly. And I thought to myself, okay, who's our Laurence Olivier? And we were trying to think.
Peter O'Toole.
Peter O'Toole, yes. Who's our Peter O'Toole?
Okay. Our next Laurence Olivier is Kenneth Branagh. We'll tell you again and again.
Yeah. You're right. So who's our next Peter O'Toole? And we were thinking, okay, it has to be somebody who has blindingly beautiful movie star looks, but they also have to have serious acting chops, because that was the 1-2 punch with Peter O'Toole. And Chris Pine was one of our candidates until... the perfect British guy came up, actually.
Oh, I...
Geez. Oh, Michael... No, it was Fassbender.
Fassbender. Sure. Irish.
Irish, never mind. Sorry about that, Irish people. On second thought, I feel like Chris Pine might have too active a sense of humor to be Peter O'Toole. So it's Fassbender by default.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah.
I'll allow it.
Yeah.
And that was one of the two trailers we saw. Going to see Coco. The other one was The Incredibles 2, which we're just gonna gloss over. It was a teaser trailer.
It reminded us very strongly of a friend's young child.
I've done this bit before, but basically you sense that Mickey is coming into the hey, haha, Mickey's got to make a lot of payouts for legal settlements now, thanks to you jerks. So better
Lassiter,
better
Lassiter. If you hadn't been hugging everybody, I wouldn't be in this position.
I don't care if you have to make Cars 75, but you're gonna. Mickey wants his money back.
And learn to keep your hands on the table during meetings.
Eyes up here, Mister.
my ears are up here.
Wow.
You okay?
Yeah, no, I'm fine.
It's your ears are up here that sent.
Yeah. Okay.
I like when I can get that kind of reaction. Mm. We did see Coco and the 22-minute Frozen movie that preceded it, which is apparently we must be the only two people in America who are not infuriated by the fact that we basically got like a 1.5 for the price of one movie.
Yeah. If you go online, you will find lots of people.
It's a wretched hive of scum and villainy.
Especially about the Frozen short.
Yeah.
People are really angry about it. I'm not the world's biggest Frozen fan in that I don't really care for it at all.
Which is funny. I wonder if that has anything to do with the fact that we've seen it 22
that
times.
That I could stage it from memory. Yeah. Yes. No, it
can
might
you
have...
tell that it came out when we had a 2.5-year-old?
So...
she was 3. Yeah.
Yeah, she was 3.
Oh, my God. No, so, yeah.
The time flies.
Yeah, we had the movie, and we've seen the movie many... Many.
Many a time.
Many times.
And I sat there going, oh, this is cute. A little bit long.
A little bit long
and a little bit thematically not connected with the Coco experience.
So my cynical thoughts on watching it were, One, Elsa and Anna have new outfits. So, oh, good. It's more costumes that people have to buy their children.
Uh-huh.
No, because this is what happened. Listen to our horrible tale and come away warned. Because, again, Frozen came out when our child was three. She had the Frozen dress. And then they came out with a stupid short where Elsa gets a cold and they're in their spring togs. And we had to get the summer Elsa dress. Or rather, I think a relative might have gotten her. But anyway, And the daughter insisted...
Dresses were obtained.
And the daughter insisted on wearing them...
Costume changes were made.
And the daughter insisted on wearing them at seasonally appropriate times. And fortunately, she's outgrown that particular thing. Mm-hmm. But I saw this and I thought, oh, wow, these are more costumes that people are going to have to buy now. They couldn't just, like, wear the stuff they used to wear in Arendelle when it snowed. There's new things to wear in Arendelle. So there were... Cynical thought number one. Cynical thought number two was, well, I know what the Magic Kingdom is getting dressed up as for holiday 2018.
Yeah.
And then cynical thought number three is... At 22 minutes, this is just long enough to be a half-hour special on the Disney Network next year.
Yep.
This is basically the same thing they did with the Toy Story short with the Battle Sores.
Yes.
Where it was 22 minutes. So it seems to me what they did here is they were like, all right, we're doing this. It'll be out on TV next year as a self-contained half-hour thing. You'll buy it on iTunes for your kid, whatever. And yeah, I mean, it's a little... It lags a little. Olaf is not my favorite character, so
no.
Having an entire short kind of revolve around him. I mean, Josh Gad does a great job with the character,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of breaking the fourth wall type jokes and things like that. It's not
the monstrosity that people would have you believe. This is the problem with online. This is weird coming from a podcast which exists merely
to make fun of things.
But
I mean, I think you can argue that we like movies too.
Things
though.
Are either the best or the worst, and there's no
or it's or
that
or,
was
or
okay.
It's, I'm so inconvenienced. Yeah. That was awful. And you know what? If the worst inconvenience you've had over the past weekend is that
you had to cool your jets until Coco could start.
If that's the worst thing that happened to you in America. In 2017, you are living a charmed life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just back off, as Elsa would say, let it go. Go get popcorn if you have to.
Hey.
Yeah. You know, and applaud the marketing people who surely sat in on these meetings and said, we need new dresses to keep the costume sales up. We're looking for a theme for the holidays for 2018 so we can get all of the children manufacturing the ornaments in the factories and, we would like something that we can also repurpose on the Disney Network as a special holiday event after Thanksgiving next year. Done, done, and done.
Let it go, let it go. The movie will soon start.
Yeah. So, yeah, we saw Coco.
There you sit and eat your corn.
I was going to say, Junior Mints doesn't scan either.
No, it doesn't.
Mm.
So, Coco. So, Coco, what did you think?
Beautiful. So yeah. Visually beautiful,
mm-hmm.
amazing, visually intricate, thoughtful in terms of world building.
Mm-hmm.
I agree
with everything you've said.
So you know how there's that observation that you can tell when there are problems in a play's performance or movie when people are like, and the costumes, and...
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot to
look at the colors.
Those are amazing, and the performances were great. I think Alana Ubach as Mama Imelda was wonderful.
Yes, she was.
She brought a lot of heart to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, the performances are great. I enjoyed that Benjamin Bratt has apparently reinvented himself as animation's premier bad guy. That said, the story is boilerplate Pixar at this point.
Yeah, it is a journey of discovery.
And I understand.
Maybe we all learn a lesson from our little friend Coco.
Well, you know, I understand that this is aimed at children, and mm-hmm. so you're not going to be, you know, wrestling with the big questions or what have you.
It's not Cloud Atlas. It doesn't have to be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I understand that we're... an audience for this, but the primary rewatching audience is approximately 30-something years younger than we are.
And they have not seen this over and over and over
exactly.
again.
So for them, this is fine. And I think that's great. God help me, we're going to end up watching it again anyway. I mean, it's going to come up during family movie night.
Mm-hmm.
And there are worse things, there are worse fates than having to watch a visually lush, richly textured, stocked with in-jokes, beautifully musical... piece like this.
Mm-hmm. No, I had the same reaction to this I had watching Moana, which is basically, well, this is very nice and very well done, and I've seen it before.
Yeah.
And
the thing that I enjoy about Disney and Pixar as an animation company is I appreciate that they're trying to come up with a new visual vocabulary for filmmaking. Because you know that one of my biggest complaints about films over the last 20 years is we really haven't had a dramatic revamp of movies as a visual experience. Like, The Matrix was the last one that rewrote the vocabulary. And the Wachowski siblings tried to do it again with Speed Racer, which, by the way, is a movie that I like far more than I should. Like, I just really love the aesthetics of that movie.
No, I came in halfway through and was going, oh, it's the Speed Racer.
And by the end of it, you're sitting down to me and making fun of Racer X, too.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Well,
the biggest problem with Speed Racer, if we can just go off on a tangent, is
the casting.
Well, he was a problem.
Chim Chim and Squirtle.
The little, you can get away with the little kid and his monkey pal when you're doing a cartoon, but when it's live action, that's a lot of little kid and that's a lot of monkey to watch.
Yeah.
And I think if you had put them in the backseat, say.
Yeah.
There's
a lot of really weird casting decisions in that movie.
There are.
But anyway, the point is, I love Speed Racer, and that is a thing that probably people who are not Wachowskis don't say often. And they keep trying to push the boundaries, but we really haven't had a whole lot of live action films that have tried to introduce a whole new language of filmmaking. And on the other hand, you have something like Disney where they really are pushing it in their animated stuff and coming, you know, and that's what I thought was really interesting about Coco was the way light is deployed throughout the movie. And it's almost tangible from the way that the marigold petals glow to all of the different lanterns and candles. And all of these glowing sources of light are a really heavy visual theme all the way through. And it adds a visual weight and texture that you don't see in a lot of live action films. And I really appreciated and enjoyed that the same way that I really liked how Moana is all about fluid lines all of the time. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, animation, you're not constrained by the laws of physics or the limits of human beings. So you can do much more interesting stuff visually, but that doesn't mean that you still can't try with live action stuff. And I feel like a lot of live action movies just kind of look the same.
Perhaps my biggest complaint with, Coco was basically in the world that they've created, which is drawn from the actual Dia de los Muertos background.
A lot of existential terror.
A lot of existential terror for a kids' movie. Where, oh yeah, because you think, well, when I die, at least the burdens of the world will be behind me, and I'll move on to what waits in the great unknown.
More terror is what waits.
And what apparently waits is more of the same.
Yeah.
Oh, and you get to die again, and this time it's permanent.
And then they have the not so comforting. No one knows what happens next. You're like, really? That's where we're going this. Huh?
Okay.
But
this is not what I signed up for.
Yeah. Well, it's the one thing that nagged the little hook at the back of my mind was the idea that the amount of fame or acclaim the amount of fame you had in your corporeal life conferred a lot of privileges in the afterlife, too. So the implication is, really, you don't count unless you're famous.
Yeah.
And that's a terrible message to send. It really is.
Also, since the form that you take in this afterlife is basically...
Well, here's how you died.
Yeah, this was how old you were when you died, so that's what you are for the rest of your time here. That really does not incentivize you to hang on until you're 90 and toothless.
No, it really doesn't. So, but no, it's, again, those are like adult nitpicks.
Yeah.
And
no, it's...
Well, you know, what I like about the movie
it's when your mind wanders when that delightful Olaf isn't singing you a song.
The thing is, though, it really is hard sometimes to find an all-ages movie that doesn't make you want to kill yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And so
you say that as a woman who went to the Emoji Movie this
God,
year.
Oh, God, yes, I did. Because my daughter picked it.
Yeah, she did.
And that was the one age-appropriate thing in the theater for a six-year-old.
Mm-hmm. An interesting observation where one of the main characters is a piece of poop. That it's age-appropriate.
I have seen things.
Yes, you have.
I have seen terrible things.
So that is our friend Coco.
Coco.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So do we want to talk about movies that we've seen on planes?
We can do that. How long have we been running, my
love?
We've
been going for 34 minutes.
So, yeah. And we can make it quick. So, I saw many movies on airplanes.
Yes, you did.
The one that I want to watch again, mm-hmm. because I liked it so much the first time, and I want to go back and dig into the performances, is Hell or High Water,
mm-hmm.
which Taylor Sheridan directed, and it stars Ben Foster and Chris Pine, and the dude doing his best, I've lost my teeth.
Jeff Bridges is his name.
Although
he should... Having seen interviews with Jeff Bridges recently...
The line is blurred,
honey. He should legally change his name to the dude.
Yeah, exactly. So, Jeff Bridges is there, and he affects a Texas accent that seems to imply he lost all of his teeth in a tragic barbecue accident.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's very good.
Okay.
It's, bear in mind, I only knew Taylor Sheridan as an actor on Sons of Anarchy before this.
Oh.
He played the sheriff for the first two seasons.
Okay.
However, what he does as a director here, which I really liked, is he knows how to use space. And he knows how to use silence. And he knows how to use it to effectively pace a story and to convey a sense of scale without getting incredibly spectacular and weird about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoyed it tremendously. Chris Pine gives a very good performance. Ben Foster gives a memorable performance as his brother. The ending is very good just because of the way Chris Pine lays things out for Jeff Bridges' character.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a beautiful and haunting scene in the middle where a bunch of cowboys are trying to drive their stock away from an encroaching prairie fire in the middle of a car chase.
Oh, wow.
And it's really good. So I would gladly see this movie again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made me want to see more of Taylor Sheridan's work.
Well, he has also done Sicario, mm-hmm. was yeah. his script.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm blanking on the one that just came out.
Oh.
Wind River. Wider it's another than a movie. While. Yes.
Yes. With two of the Avengers.
Yeah.
There we go.
So, yes. I believe that's how it's billed.
Yes. Wind
the
River.
The movie that brings two Avengers back together again.
Yes.
So is Wind River part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
You know, I'd have to see it, and then I'm sure I can make backstory for it. The same way that I've now decided that Red Sparrow was the black movie we all wanted.
The Black Widow movie, yes.
I am now kind of sad imagining Scarlett Johansson seeing that trailer and then her eyes narrow and she barks at her assistant, get me Kevin on the phone.
So I want to talk about two movies
I've
seen on planes.
Can I send a really angry edible bouquet to Ike Perlmutter because this could have been a thing? So you want to see two? You talk about your two and then I'll talk about another one I watched.
Yeah.
On
planes. Mm-hmm. I saw Fences.
Uh huh.
Which is,
So I have a weird relationship with movies that start off as plays because...
Go on.
Well, because stage acting is so different from film acting.
It is quite true.
And the problem is you occasionally get stage actors who are stage acting on film, and it's just so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I get embarrassed both for myself and for the entire production.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to claim to be the world's biggest August Wilson fanboy.
No.
Well,
it's
August heads, we call ourselves, and we travel around the country during the month of August looking for plays that are done by August Wilson. Yes. But I have seen Joe Turner's Come and Gone in the theater, and mm-hmm. I have I've read Fences. I've not seen it staged.
Yeah.
So I enjoy the source material. The source material is not a problem for me.
Yeah.
I didn't like the movie as much as I thought I would, and that said, I really did enjoy the performances, particularly Viola Davis.
Oh, well, Viola Davis is a national treasure.
Well, she is quite good in this.
Yeah.
I do not think...
Viola Davis is our Katharine Hepburn, yes or no?
Yes.
There we go. All right.
Very much so. Okay. Whereas Denzel Washington gives a very fine performance, Denzel Washington does not direct that movie very well at all. It is not...
So with the caveat that I just quelled about Taylor Sheridan's command of space and pacing and silence and this and that, and he does have a nice visual eye. Actors who direct, it's a really tricky transition because I think it's a whole different set of skills.
Yeah.
And there's a big difference between understanding and interpreting something as an actor versus being able to understand and interpret it on the many levels the director has to bring to it, too.
No, I think that's true. And it's really by the book direction. Mm. It doesn't uplift the script or the story. It just sort of,
It doesn't bring out any nuances or enhance any performances.
They would have been better served just filming the stage version.
Oh, God.
Honestly, like they did for the Death of a Salesman that Dustin Hoffman was in the 80s.
Oh, that one, yeah.
It also isn't helped. Michael T. Williamson plays Gabriel, and basically, if you've seen his character in Forrest Gump, hey, he's back! And he's in an August Wilson play.
Oh.
You're
not making me want to see it.
No, and it is... Mm-hmm. Boy, it is a lot of shouting. That is a lot of shouting. I saw this on the back of an airplane seat.
Yes,
and I cannot imagine watching people 40 feet high
screaming,
shouting at you for 40 minutes about the state of life in Pittsburgh in the 1960s. So,
God, imagine being in Pittsburgh in the 1960s but shouting neighbors.
I am not going.
Quick, Johnny, go set the river on fire just to divert the neighbors.
My recurring thought throughout watching Fences was, God, Denzel Washington's neighbors must just be, oh, Jesus. Oh,
Ma, I found the matches. Should I head down to the Cuyahoga?
Oh, he's... First off, that's in Cleveland.
Oh, it's the Monongahela, my bad.
Yes. There are three rivers in Pittsburgh.
I believe there's
and
a
you
state?
Missed all of them. All of them.
Sorry.
I'm sorry to nitpick there.
Okay, Monongahela. Fine. Yes,
the Ohio, the Allegheny. Yes, we've named all the rivers in Pittsburgh.
I was close. I had a river in Ohio.
Yes, yeah. So, no. Denzel Washington's poor neighbors. Oh,
get set on fire too?
Oh, he's talking. Yeah, yes, it was Lake Erie, I think, that got set on fire, not the Cuyahoga River. Boy, this has gone far afield.
I think this is why people listen.
August Wilson did not write any play. He did not while I'm doing my Pittsburgh plays, I'm also working on some Cleveland material.
Why don't I work my way around the Great Lakes?
Yes. Dying industrial cities. I've got some Baltimore work you might like.
David Simon looks up from whatever he's doing and screams, no!
No, you don't. So Fences.
So Fences.
It's
so Viola Davis gives a great performance.
Viola Davis is great. She
Denzel
is great.
Washington does a Denzelian performance.
Jovan Adepo. And forgive me, Jovan, if I've totally butchered your name. He's quite good as the son.
Yeah.
And that's a very critical role in that play.
Mm-hmm.
But it just doesn't work as a movie.
Mm. I'm sorry to hear that.
No, I was disappointed.
It is. It's disappointing when something you're like, this
I was
should
looking
work.
Forward
Why doesn't
to.
It? Yeah, exactly.
On that same trip, I also watched The Founder, which I'm not going to really get into, with Michael Keaton as Ray Kroc. That was good.
I understand that there are good performances, but it doesn't hang together.
Good performances doesn't hang together. And boy, if you're looking for strong female characters, move on, friend.
Because
all the women in there are empty vessels
I'm
for Ray Kroc's...
I'm just here to be a prop.
Empty vessels for Ray Kroc's milkshake.
Yeah.
So,
Wow, that's...
Yeah.
That's... We're going to have to change the audience rating on this podcast. I feel really uncomfortable having
Sorry about that. And so the other film that I started to watch on that flight after Fences, the chaser from the shoutiness, was La La Land.
Oh my God. You guys, the only thing that kept me from doing a live podcast of Phil's reactions during the rest of La La Land was I was not sure if Jason would actually consent to posting a podcast that would be nothing but frothing at the mouth and profanity and...
So I started to watch it on the plane, and I thought, oh God, the sound is really terrible on this plane.
No, the mixing in that movie is terrible.
Because I can't really, you can hear the music, but the lyrics are all muddied, and and so I went home and taped it off of the HBO, and...
off the HBO.
Yeah.
With the hi-fi.
Off the talking box with the pictures.
With the quadrophenia.
And, no, the sound mixing is terrible on La La Land.
It really is.
And every song, there are like basically two songs in the movie that they just play over and over again. It's the worst kind of movie in that it's, boy, this business is show, man. It's a hard life, but that's what we're into.
I feel like if your daughter or son comes home and says they're going to date somebody in the arts, what you do is you sit them down with this movie, and that it's a very effective prophylactic.
Yeah, no, there is one scene that made me smile. It's the scene where they're dancing up in the foothills.
Yeah.
That was pretty and a nice little throwback to musicals, but... Boy, mostly it came across because the sound is so bad and the music is so amateurish. It felt like a little high school play that someone writes and someone's noodling on the Casio keyboard.
Yeah.
It was like Enter the Nightman sketch from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. It was about that quality of showmanship.
So my problem with the film actually came down to the story itself.
Oh, well... we haven't even gotten to the story. Because,
again, the aesthetics are beautiful.
Yeah.
Because the costuming is on point, which, and I found it really interesting. Whoever did the costuming did a great job. And I very much enjoy the set decoration, which, again, when you start noticing these things, you're going, wow, that's masterfully executed. That's a sign that your brain is looking at things because it's not...
It's not being engaged by the story itself or the performances.
Or you're like, if I have to pay attention to this, I'm just going to dissolve into a black puddle of anti-joy. So again, the things to like are, it's very pretty. If I was to walk into a tiki bar and they had a wall of screens all playing it on mute, you'd be like, oh, that's nice. The same way, like, our local tiki bar does that with Polynesian movies.
Beach blanket movies.
Beach blanket movies, yeah. And I like that, you know? Because if you listen to an actual beach blanket movie, you can feel yourself getting dumber by the second. But, you know, when it's just visual wallpaper, that's great. And La La Land is beautiful visual wallpaper. That said, the ending is hogwash.
Oh, God,
and,
yes.
And unearned.
Yeah. No.
And makes no sense and comes with no explanation. And I realize that, oh, life has no easy answers. And sometimes these things just happen. But, you know, when you have a movie and it's self-contained, your job is to take your hermetically sealed little world, define the rules, and then play out the story in the world that you've created.
Yeah.
If you're going to break out of that structure, it has to be in the service of the narrative. And they don't do that here. So.
Yeah, that was a... I am puzzled that that movie was ever thought of as one of the top films to come out in 2016.
Musicals.
Yeah.
Musicals, it's pretty.
Musicals, it's about the greatness of
Oh, there's no Hollywood. Business like show business. And yeah. It's any time you make a movie about show people in any way, shape, or form, it is basically awards bait. It's the same thing with Birdman, where because it's about messed up actors, of course.
Or The Greatest Show on Earth, which is about messed up circus people.
Yeah. Well, it's The Greatest Show on Earth, Phil.
So,
both hated it.
I did not enjoy La La Land at all.
Nope.
So, take that movie that came out a year ago.
That we finally watched, yeah.
So that brings us to the end of our own magical
journey. Actually, no, there's one movie.
I did see a documentary
that I really liked, and I should say that I enjoyed for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, let's end on a high note.
Yeah, let's do that. The documentary is called Dancer. It came out in 2016. It's about I don't think they're called Sergei Polunin who grew up behind the Iron Curtain and got moved from gymnastics into ballet at a very early age. Was that
after he couldn't make the program where he goes around killing people in his red dress?
We don't know that he doesn't do that. This documentary suggests he has a rich and varied life. Mm-hmm. But anyway, young Sergei was put in ballet by his ambitious parents who wanted better for him.
Sure.
And what you see in the documentary is a prodigiously gifted dancer who is really sick of dancing, but literally does not know what else to do and does not know what else he is. And it is also a really heartrending look at a family falling apart at the same time and about the sacrifices people make for other people's dreams and the responsibilities that get laid on from one generation to the next over that. And the sacrifices that art demands, both willingly and without even realizing it. And this dude is just amazing when you watch him move. You watch him leap and do things that you think should not even be possible. And anyway, it's called Dancer. And
where could someone watch this if they wanted to?
I was about to get to IMDb. You can see it on Amazon.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's not on Netflix, though.
No, sadly.
Well, burn it to the ground.
Yeah. It's on Amazon.
That's fine. That's fine.
No, Netflix says their documentary collection has been dwindling.
Oh, that's a shame.
I know, because that's why I watch them. But like three of my favorites just cycled out, so okay. I'm super bummed. Anyway, we did see movies. I did see Baywatch, but I think at this point the tide has gone out on that movie.
The position of the sun in the sky suggests to me. One of the things I've been
noticing...
Well, eventually
we get to the point where we can talk about the state's influence for better or for worse on cinematic comedy.
Oh, sure.
But the thing you've been noticing, you said?
No, the thing I've been noticing lately is podcast bloat.
No.
Because all my football podcast or soccer podcasts now stretch past the hour mark routinely.
No.
There's not that much soccer in the world.
All right, you guys, we've already hit the 50-minute mark. Yeah. So I think it's time to thank those of you who have hung in, who have tweeted suggestions at us, and who have let us know how you like or didn't like past episodes. Thank you for hanging in there. We still owe you one more members only podcast before the end of the year. I do have David Wunderlich's movie queued up in my iTunes, and Phil and I will carve out the time to watch it and then do a special members only podcast just for you guys.
Yep.
And we will also carve out the time. We do love doing this. We'll carve out the time to do one more end of the year trailers podcast before 2018 hits.
I think so. At least one more episode.
Exactly.
We owe it to the people.
Or not. Maybe we'll argue that we don't.
No.
Anyway, thank you
again. You've done enough.
Yes, and so have we. Thank you for listening. I'm Lisa Schmeiser. This is Phil Michaels with Phil and
Lisa.
That
is not Philip Michaels. I'm Philip Michaels. Stop trying to impersonate me.
I was pointing at you when I said this is Philip Michaels.
Well, they can't see that.
Yes, they can. They can see everything.
Oh, dear. I better put on pants.
That's what the coordinator says.